From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Continued fighting in Ukraine has forced thousands into bomb shelters in the eastern city of Donetsk. The UN Children's Agency UNICEF said that children face a particularly serious health risk from disease. The agency has called for an immediate halt to hostilities between government and rebel forces and for both sides to keep children out of harm's way. Daniel Johnson reports from the United Nations.
At least 1,000 children have been forced into underground bomb shelters in Ukraine amid renewed fighting and a fast deteriorating humanitarian situation, UNICEF said Tuesday.
Children suffer psychologically, are missing out on schooling, and are at risk of various diseases.
UNICEF representative Giovanna Barbara is speaking on the line from Kiev. She said that the most vulnerable youngsters are living in shelters in Donetsk in the east of the country and are not going out because of the security situation. UNICEF has visited 12 shelters and delivered hygiene kits, but Ms. Barbara said there was not a regular pipeline of access to the rebel-controlled areas. One of its major concerns is the threat of polio, since 1.5 million children under 5 years old have not yet had the vaccine. As separatists continue to clash with government forces in Ukraine, latest UN figures indicate at least 5,187 people killed since last April and 11,515 wounded. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
As some of the dwindling number of Holocaust survivors gathered with dozens of world leaders in Auschwitz, Poland, to mark 70 years since the infamous concentration camp was liberated in January 1945 by the Soviet Union's Red Army, there were complaints from among those rescued that Russia's president wasn't invited to participate. RT's Paula Slyer reports from Auschwitz.
The Polish president has laid a wreath at the Wall of Death in the Auschwitz camp, which is around 5 kilometers from where I'm standing. I'm in Birkenau, which is the main part of the camp. This is where the trains arrived, where the selections took place, and where 4 crematoria operated nonstop. There are delegations representing some 42 countries. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, however, will not be attending. He was not formally invited by the Warsaw government. In his place will be Sergei Ivanov, who is the chief of staff of the Russian presidential administration. Now, when Russian President Putin was here 10 years ago, there were 1,500 survivors who took part in the commemoration. Today, there are only 300, and this is why organizers are saying that in all likelihood, this will be the last large gathering of Auschwitz survivors. Many of these survivors have been critical of the decision not to formally invite the Russian president, and saying, of course, that it was the Red Army who liberated this camp 70 years ago today.
The Russians liberated the camp. The Russians liberated the camp, not the Americans, not the Russians. And makes sense that the people of the government, if not Putin, is to be there. It's obvious.
The decision by the Polish government not to invite the Russian president to the ceremony marking 70 years since the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp is a scandal. How can you fail to invite the leader of a country that fought against Nazi Germany and liberated Auschwitz?
1.4 million people died in Auschwitz-Birkenau. The majority of them were Jews.
That was RT's Paula Slyer reporting from Auschwitz, Poland, Tuesday. The Israeli military has dismissed 43 members from its elite intelligence 8200 unit. The dismissed soldiers wrote an open letter in September protesting Israeli covert actions towards Palestinians, particularly in the 2014 military operation in Gaza. In the letter, written in the wake of Operation Protective Edge, the 10 officers and 33 soldiers wrote that they, quote, refused to take part in actions against the Palestinians and refused to continue serving as tools in deepening the military control over the occupied territories, closed quote. Following an investigation, the IDF Monday announced it would dismiss the authors of the letter. The IDF's office said in a statement, quote, there is no room in the IDF for refusal, and we view the exploitation of military service for the expression of a political stance gravely, closed quote. Europe's top human rights body called mass surveillance practices in the U.S. and the U.K. a fundamental threat to human rights and a violation of the right to privacy. Press TV's Waqar Rizbi reports.
The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe has expressed its deep concerns about far-reaching systems used by Washington and London to collect, store, and analyze data of private citizens. The report has described the scale of spying by the U.S. National Security Agency, revealed by whistleblower Edward Snowden, as, quote, stunning. It also says that British laws that give the country's spying agency wide-ranging powers are incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. The report says that contrary to what American and British officials claim, mass surveillance has failed to stop terrorist attacks. Our correspondent Amina Taylor joins us now from London. Amina, tell us more about these concerns expressed by Europe's top rights body, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe.
Well, they wouldn't be the first body to express these concerns. We've already had conversations with one of the leading rights group over here, Liberty, Big Brother Watch, and so on. And they highlight some of those issues also. The idea that the government's security agencies will be able to, through some kind of mass trawl, highlight and pinpoint those who would be of concern to the nation is simply ludicrous. We all know that this is about maintaining good relationships, it's about maintaining good contacts. That is the only way in which you're going to weed through so-called terror threats. You're not going to do it by analyzing everybody's email, everybody's communication through their mobile phones and so on. And there's been a big move here, especially by the Liberal Democrats and their supporters, to stand in front of what's being dubbed the Snooper's Charter, where law enforcement agencies, spy agencies and so on would have the right to not go to a judge to get any kind of order to access your files, but to do so directly because they felt it was necessary and within the bounds, quote unquote, of the legal system. And someone has to say no more to this, because once these erosions of basic human privacy laws and liberties go, who's to say the next government might not take them any further? And this is a question Theresa May and the spy agencies have not been able to answer. They've not been able to give guarantees that in order to try and catch the bad guys, they won't inconvenience the good guys.
Sunday's victory by the radical leftist party Syriza in Greece sent shockwaves through the European capitals and capitals around the world. First, we have this report from Press TV.
Alexis Tsipras's anti-austerity party, Syriza, won Sunday's general elections and forged a coalition with nationalist independent Greeks party to win a majority at parliament. The new Greek PM says Syriza's victory is a victory for all Europeans who fight austerity.
I'd like to thank all for this unforeseen wave of support and solidarity. It comes from every corner of Europe. Our victory is a victory for all the people of Europe who fight against austerity.
Tsipras's first priority will be to rework the terms of Greece's €240 billion bailout, which Athens received in 2010 to help resolve its economic recession. In return for the bailout money, Greece was forced to slash public sector spending, cut wages and pensions, and introduce a program of privatization. This has led to a mounting public discount, with Syriza promising to reverse much of it. The party and other opponents of Greek's austerity drive say the tough measures have only made the economy shrink. Left and right-wing opposition parties in Britain, Ireland, France, Italy, Spain and Portugal have hailed Syriza's victory as a reproach to the tough public budget cuts imposed in the recent economic crisis. Spain's Podemos party, which has topped several opinion polls and is aiming for an absolute majority in the country's November elections, says Greeks are going to have a true president, not a delegate of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Germany, the paymaster for Eurozone bailout packages, however, has urged the new Greek government to uphold its commitments to international lenders. The head of the Eurozone's finance minister also warned that Greece's place in the Eurozone depends on its commitments on debt and austerity. Experts believe the rise of the anti-austerity party in Greece further highlights the wrong economic path the Eurozone had taken.
The essential problem is that the European elite has no solution whatsoever except to increase the debt. And their quantitative easing does nothing except put money into the banks which is not being lent. That money goes for bankers' bonuses and then into rising asset prices. It does not go into what matters in people's lives. It is whether or not they have jobs.
It's a matter of time whether the new Greek government would be able to get support from its European partners to write off its debt and ultimately bring a relief to austerity-hit Greeks. Analysts say if this fails, things will become more serious since the chorus of change has already begun in the Eurozone amid a mounting popular discontent with their governments' economic policies.
Longtime author and political commentator Tariq Ali hosts the program The World Today from Tel Assur. He spoke with Stathis Kouvalakis, a member of Syriza's Central Committee, about the party's progressive alternative for Greece and perhaps the rest of Europe.
Very briefly, the history of Greece since the Second World War has been very tormented. A huge civil war that took place both during the German occupation and carried on afterwards. The civil war was won by the right and the extreme right in Greece, and it has dominated Greek politics for longer than people imagine. That the politics of that period dominated Greece during the Cold War. When it appeared in the 60s that a moderate center party of the left, might win the elections, the United States and NATO organized a coup d'etat, and the military ruled Greece for several years after that. A brutal period in Greek history, tortures, expulsions, people leaving the country and going into exile. And when this finally ended, there was a great deal of hope that the party would now come to power and transform Greece. Well, they did come to power, but they didn't transform Greece. And so the crisis continued. The question arose after the 2008 Wall Street crash, what was going to happen to countries like Greece, Spain, and Italy who were being crushed? The attempt by the European Union and the Troika to impose austerity has now failed. This is why, already in 2012, Syriza had become the largest party on the left and was threatening to challenge and take over from the extreme center parties, the conservatives and the so-called left party PASOK. They got close to winning the 2012 elections, but a campaign of intimidation, fear, was so fierce that especially in the countryside and amongst older people, they were frightened off. Since 2012, the mood has changed because the conservative government in power, backed by its allies in parliament, has failed miserably. Greece is in a mess. Unemployment is high. Unemployed people can't be paid benefits. There are food shortages because people cannot afford to buy the food that is available in many of the shops. Barter has existed in this country, so change is now expected. And because the right and its allies have failed, the tune of the Western media, too, has changed. January the 19th, New York Times, and the headline is, "An appeal to populism could pay off in Greece." Stathis, let's start with this New York Times headline. I mean, what is the meaning of the word populism? Why do they use it?
Populism is just the name of the big other of mainstream politics. Everything that is considered as alien to mainstream politics is characterized as populism. So it's a category that amalgamates the far right, xenophobic, nationalist parties, and also parties that reject the neoliberal dogma. And this is the case of Syriza. The difference is that Syriza is the party of the left, but it is a party of the left that has fought against neoliberalism. And the crucial stake of the party before even the crisis in the 2000 years, and that was at stake in its internal debate and confrontation, was the rejection of the strategy of an alliance of a center-left type, because that has been the great trap in which many forces and parties of the alternative left have fallen into in the recent decades, more specifically in France with the Communist Party, but also in Italy, where the very promising Rifondazione Comunista experiment miserably failed when they entered the Prodi government. So Syriza had sorted that out positively before even the crisis, and that is, I think, the starting point for its capacity to become a credible alternative in the situation created by that very violent crisis and shock austerity policies that have been imposed.
Let's assume that Syriza wins. They win the election, and then what?
Syriza is at the gates of power. I mean, most opinion polls, but also the atmosphere in Greece, predict a victory of Syriza. The only thing that we do not know yet is how large this victory will be. And this is a crucial parameter, of course, of the situation, the issue of the parliamentary majority, more specifically. But Syriza comes to power with a very clear mandate, which is, in a way, the outcome of the situation itself. And this mandate can be summed up in three basic points. First of all, liberate the country from the burden of that unsustainable and completely absurd debt. Second, make a break with austerity politics, with all the mechanisms of the memoranda. And third, restore democracy, because the memoranda and the specific way those new liberal policies have been imposed to Greece meant that democracy itself has been destroyed. Any notion of popular and national sovereignty is simply non-existent. The parliamentary institutions have become just a facade behind which, you know, the governments have been just the executors, actually, of what had been decided with the Troika. All the functioning of the state apparatus is constantly monitored by the Troika. And the evolution of the situation meant that a very authoritarian state apparatus came and produced by the situation. So we need to break with that authoritarianism, which has penetrated deeply into the state, but also into Greek society itself. So this is the mandate of Syriza. That is its mission.
The implementation is not going to be as easy as some people imagine, because the pressures that will come from the European Union, the Troika, principally the German government, the German banking elite, are going to make it difficult to negotiate a settlement that favors the Greek people. It may happen, we can't exclude it. The question is, what if the negotiations with the institutions of the European Union fail? What is Syriza going to do? It is pledged to demolish the debt, or to negotiate their way out of it, like the Argentinians did, probably. But what if the conditions are still unfavorable?
Well, the issue of Syriza is that we don't want to move unilaterally on the issue of the debt, except if we are forced to move unilaterally. And I think that's the only sensible solution. We have to be clear about one thing. The so-called bailouts to Greece was absolutely not money that went to the Greek economy or to the Greek state, and even more so to the Greek society. It was exclusively went to repay the debt, right? So if they say, no, we reject your proposals, we have a weapon. And the weapon is that this will immediately lead to default, actually. And default will provoke a big mess and a big turmoil within the European Union, within the European Central Bank, because everyone knows that the Greek debt as such is a negligible part of the overall European debt.
Because were the European Union to play hardliners and say, okay, we can't do this, not because the debt is that large in terms of what we have, but in terms of the domino effect. If we allow the Syriza people to do it, the Spanish will ask for it next, the Irish, and who knows, even the Portuguese might begin to demand something different, so stop it. If they were stupid enough to do that, which they are capable of, then the openings in Europe could be huge, because if a Syriza government then defaulted, that would create complete panic, And it would bring people out onto the streets, in my opinion. You see, one of the things you said, which I think is extremely important to stress, and it's linked to the South American experience, that in order to combat partially successfully the propaganda of the Western media networks who were saying this is a dictator, this is Chavez's Venezuela, it's a dictatorship, when they had more elections than virtually any other government in South and North America combined. The only way support could be seen, since the West refused to accept the election results, saying this was a fluke, this was a freak, was to get people out onto the streets. I mean, I remember after they tried to topple Chavez, being in Caracas, and there were 1.5 million people on the streets to mark the anniversary of the coup. And when you see the people on the streets, you realize the value and importance of mass mobilizations. So I've been saying to Greek friends and comrades that a key aspect is going to be, whatever you do, even when there are negotiations taking place, that the level of mass mobilization should be high. I think trade union, mass, popular democratic mobilizations are critically important in at least the first 6 months to a year of a Syriza government.
The way Syriza strategically deals with this challenge is the following one. First of all, we are absolutely aware of the fact that we owe our rise and now to governmental power, to the importance and strength of the mass movements Greek society experienced, especially the two first years of the crisis between 2010 and 2012. We had approximately 40 days of general strike, huge mass demonstrations, the squares and places and streets of the country being occupied by hundreds of thousands of people for weeks, a bit like the Indignados movement in Spain. And it's no coincidence if it is in Greece and Spain that we have this new political landscape with those forces of the radical left that, you know, have risen in a spectacular way these last years. So popular mobilization has already been the key that led us to where we are now. On the issue of the break with austerity politics, we do not negotiate that. No. This is non-negotiable. So we have a core set of commitments which start from extremely basic things, the satisfaction of the immediate vital needs of the population that has been completely marginalized, of all those lives that have been broken by the austerity politics. So we want, you know, electricity, health coverage for the entire population. We will give money for food stamps. But we also want to bring back the minimum wage to the level it was before the crisis. We need political success. We need concrete measures that will give confidence to the people, that will give a concrete possibility for them to mobilize again, and actually to go even further than what appears as moderate but absolutely essential objectives.
This will, of course, necessitate, let's put it like this, stinging the bourgeoisie, the Greek bourgeoisie, which has had it without any regulation or controls at all. They have made money like nobody else. The shipowners' mafia pays no taxes at all, and is very proud of the fact and boasts about it. Ah, Greece, they're in our pockets. Well, the politicians and the media are in the pockets of the oligarchs, as we know. So they will have to be taxed. And secondly, an important question is also, for how long can you leave the church to be untaxed? I know this is a very sensitive question in Greece, but they own large tracts of property. You know, we don't have the image of sort of peasant monks or workers' monks. We have the church as an institution, which something has to be done about, in the sense that it should pay its share of the normal taxes, which helps the ordinary people. They shouldn't even be opposed to it. So that's one big issue on which previous governments have refused to do anything, taxing the rich and the very rich. And linked to that, of course, is the question of stopping privatizations and making sure that the utilities, which you were talking about, hospitals, schools, are in fact owned by the state. Because that you can't depend on privatization and privatized companies to deliver the goods, as we are finding out in Britain. and in other parts of Europe?
Actually, they are selling the infrastructures, they are selling the airports, the ports of Greece, the electricity, the company, the water company. So, I mean, basic utilities. And this is completely scandalous. I mean, completely scandalous. Everyone knows that there is a lot of corruption behind this. The Qataris and a Greek tycoon have recently bought what is considered as probably the best operation of real estate in Europe. It is the old airport of Athens, nearby the sea. So a very large, actually, piece of land that was sold to these people for 70 euros per square meter. So it's hardly to imagine, you know, the kind of corruption that was behind this kind of deal, let's say. So it's perfectly possible, purely in legal terms, to cancel most of the privatization, not to say all that have been done recently, and actually to take back all these assets. Furthermore, I mean, you know, the Greek bourgeoisie, as you said, is a mixture of a subaltern bourgeoisie that considered its own country as, you know, a colony in a way, that never had a proper national project of developing, which is typical of a peripheral country, and extreme neoliberalism. Fiscal reform is absolutely needed. Environmental legislation is absolutely needed. And this is crucial to break with the previous model of development. Because you see, the memoranda, we say neoliberalism. Actually, there is a project behind this. And the most visible part is the privatization of the coast and the type of tourist industry they want to create.
The big difference between Spain and Greece on one level is that unlike Greece, where there is a far right and an openly fascist far right, these are not post-fascists or neo-fascists or liberal. These are fascists who demonstrate on the streets with fascist banners, who observe Hitler's birthday, who are embedded even in the special security organs of the state. That you don't have in Spain because of the past and because a lot of the extreme right integrated itself in traditional right-wing conservatism. So Podemos does not have to confront this threat, whereas a Syriza government, it could be confronted by right-wing street mobilizations encouraged by the previous regime. And how are they going to deal with that?
I mean, I think that the issue of the rise of
CPR Metro,
not just a far right, but of a proper neo-Nazi organization like Golden Dawn, which has entered parliament with 7% of the vote in 2012, but nearly got 9% of the vote in the recent European elections. The situation of Greece is in a way comparable to that of Germany after the Versailles treaties, because the people really have the feeling that they have been brutally pauperized, humiliated socially, but also nationally due to the Troika rule, right? And it is on that ground that this, you know, primitive and completely delirious form of nationalism developed by Golden Dawn became suddenly relevant for some people. And there is the possibility of a strategy of tension in Greece, Italian style, let's say, you know, Italian style like the 1970s. But Golden Dawn, despite its appeal within Greek society, has not developed into a mass party, properly speaking. It's you know, a small organization of thugs, which is funded by, you know, the kind of mafia type of operations and isolated, I mean, fractions, let's say, but relatively marginal fractions of the Greek bourgeoisie, who just want to use these thugs in order to, you know, make, sort out issues at the level of their neighborhood, of their firm, of their company, and so on and so forth. They want Port of Piraeus, for instance, with the help of Golden Dawn, some ship owners, etc. So we have this situation that is one of the problems that, indeed, a Syriza government will have to face.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.